at some stage in our lives, we'll all have to go under the knife, be it heart surgery, a badly broken bone, or even for cosmetic reasons. But what about the men and women charged with one of the highest pressurised jobs there is? Is it all long hours and bad conditions, or is it a well-paid profession worth all the stress? For this week's Industry Review, we're going to delve into the lives of surgeons. To discuss this, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. David Burke. He's an interventional cardiologist at the Beacon Hospital and James's Hospital. Dr. Pat Kiley, he's an orthopaedic surgeon, mainly working with children in Crumlin. And Professor John O'Byrne, he's a consultant orthopaedic surgeon at Kappa National Orthopaedic Hospital and at the Mater Hospital. Guys, you're very, very welcome to the programme. I've been looking forward to this all week. So thanks very much for coming in, first of all. And I'm delighted to have you all here in studio. David Burke, I'll start with you.
Yes.
Maybe you might just give us a high-level view of your job and what you do.
Yeah, I suppose I trained through the Irish system, went to the States. I was over in Harvard for a couple of years, and now I'm back in Ireland the last 3 years. I'm an interventional cardiologist, and I work both in the Beacon and James's. And I suppose really what we do, or the main part of my job, is to fix people's heart arteries, your coronary arteries.
You're the stent and valve man.
I'm the stent and valve guy, yeah, that's right.
Okay, and what you say, and again, it's a nice way of describing, you're a fancy mechanic who does her best for people, as would most jobs. So it's a technical skill is what you do, and I think, like, obviously you build those skills up over the years, and you worked internationally.
It takes a lot of practice, takes a lot of time, but in the grand scheme of things, it's working on an engine essentially. And I suppose when I'm talking to patients and trying to explain these things, that's what I break it down to.
Yeah.
I mean, a stent in the end of the day looks like the spring in a biro, and the trick is to get it into position through a pinhole in your wrist, and we're able to do that now. So it's nifty and clever stuff, all right, but in the end of the day, it's mechanics and plumbing.
Okay, let me bring in Dr. Patrick Kiley. He's an orthopaedic surgeon. Patrick, you're very welcome to the program. Your work is mainly with children out in Crumlin Hospital.
Yeah, so a lot of my time is spent with your kids. I suppose the three facets. One is the injuries. So a lot of kids get broken bones. I think the average child breaks 1.5 bones in his childhood. So they keep us busy. I'm delighted with the weather today, I have to say. If I'm on call in Crumlin, this would keep it pretty quiet. But sunny days and long hours, we tend to get a quadrupling trauma.
Yeah, I was amazed by that the long days of the summer actually mean that your demand actually increases, because virtually there's more kids out playing and more bones will be broken.
Way more. We can see almost an exponential rise coming from winter through to summer.
That's incredible.
And it'll calm down again in October. So that's one part of it. And I suppose allied to that, we'd have the kids with injuries like on the sporting field. So I have a kind of specialist interest in the kind of sports injury scene with children, because their growing bones are different from adults. And then I suppose with the other elements we look at a lot would be kids who have queries about whether they have abnormal ways that they're developing, kind of flat feet or bow legs, or and then the more serious things where they actually are growing deformed, like spinal deformity, which is a lot of my work, hip deformity and that kind of stuff.
And then our third guest I'm delighted to welcome to the program is Professor John O'Byrne, and he's a consultant orthopaedic surgeon at Kappa Orthopaedic and the Mater Private. And you're very welcome, John. You might just tell us a little bit about your world so we can get the conversation going.
Right, thank you. Well, I do joint replacement, so knee replacements and hip replacements, and another part of my job is involved in training and teaching, so training orthopaedic surgeons and teaching medical students. But the clinical side of it is predominantly, over the last few years, is more revolving around knee replacement and hip replacement surgery.
Okay. And just maybe to ask you about the technology that has come into all our worlds and all our business worlds over the last... In your world, it must be absolutely just massive. Can you keep up with the technology?
Yeah, it is massive. And in fact, one of the challenges is that with increasing technologies, increasing costs.
Yeah.
And there's a problem about that, because there's a limited amount of money. The second issue that has arisen with new technology is that it often hasn't been better than what exists. And for example, say total hip replacement is an operation that is so successful that it is very hard to demonstrate or to present something that is better than something that works already. And over the last, I suppose, 10 or 15 years, there has been different things tried, very innovative and very attractive technology, but some of it has not been successful. Some of it has actually been worse than the its predecessor. So it's a difficult thing. You know, the challenge of introducing technology is difficult in both those areas, both in terms of the cost and in terms of proving its effectiveness.
Okay. One of the things I wanted to understand is your workplace, and I wanted to understand how stressful it can be. I think you say, John, that that the actual operating theatre itself is quite a calm place, but the stress tends to be outside of it. Is that right?
Yes. That
and I see your colleagues are nodding their heads.
That is right.
Explain that to me.
I think it comes as a bit of a surprise to people who aren't involved in working in operating rooms and so on. Well, in the operating room, most of what we do, we're very comfortable doing them. We like doing this. It's a very controlled environment. And while we're operating, in fact, nobody is asking us to do anything else. So we have that time in our week where we just have one task to do.
And you're focused on your skill set.
Yeah, and we like doing it. Yeah. And it becomes, when you do these operations over and over again, they become, you know, routine. And so there's not a stress level so much. Every so often, there might be issues, but infrequently. So that, in fact, the time when we're operating is the kind of the most relaxing time almost.
It's fascinating.
David, can I just ask you about when an operation is cancelled or when we hear about operations or thing, how frustrating is that for you as the person who's there ready and waiting to do your job and you're told it's cancelled for whatever reason?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it is the most frustrating part of the job, and I suppose very genuinely the most enjoyable and the part that you like the best in terms of the job is operating and is the procedures. And I suppose it's very frustrating for two reasons. I mean, you want to get on and help people, and then on the opposite side of that, obviously, you're trying to explain these restrictions to people who you've essentially promised you're going to help them along. So it's a very difficult process. But I suppose we try and structure and we do our best to make sure that doesn't happen as often as you'd think.
Yeah, but it does happen, and
of course
you just
it does,
and you
yeah.
have to. And what about your experience around it, Pat? Is it something that frustrates you?
It's a real and live issue. I think every single one of us, you feel an innate responsibility for the patient who's come in front of you with their problem. That it's your responsibility to fix it. It's not the hospital. You don't derogate that responsibility to somebody else. So you really take that as a personal thing. And when you see that parent, that family, and that child, or whatever situation, you really feel you got to look after them. And it's always a challenge for us if we realise that the system won't give us the capacity to treat people in a timely manner.
Yeah.
And some of these people are going to deteriorate. That's a real issue for us. With the kids scene, it's very clear that some of them are going to deteriorate significantly, maybe 20-25% if on a waiting list.
Yeah.
And then you're going to end up with more difficult and risky procedures, that kind of thing.
It seems like a crazy sort of prophecy, doesn't it? That you know, you spend, it's because it's not all about the cost, is it? Like we have the fourth highest cost in Europe in terms of our healthcare system, yet, you know, you speak openly about your frustration. So really it isn't about an open checkbook.
But even if it came to the cost, there's no real sense in the system we may have in that by the delay, say in the kids scene for a scoliosis operation, and so a spinal deformity operation to correct their spine, we know from the time that it takes to get to see us and then the time they're waiting, their condition will have advanced so much that it will cost us 15 to 30% more to eventually treat them. And so we could treat every fourth or every sixth kid for free.
Yeah.
For free, for the same amount of money.
So that's a really bad business logic, isn't it?
If you look at a business model, you wouldn't start with this, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And sending people elsewhere to overseas or whatever to get them treated is an expeditious way to maybe get them treated, but often we're paying 2 to 3 times what it would cost to treat them at home. So that's also not, if you look at it, a cost efficacy way of dealing with it. It's not very logical, and of course you're breaking up relationships with doctors and nurses and familiarity in hospitals if you start sending people willy-nilly right, left and centre. And of course in the more complex situations in cardiac or in orthopaedic, like they're the one group of people, our patients, that outside hospitals probably don't want to take. So you end up again with the same problem coming back to your door.
Okay.
So
and we've loads of texts in. If you wouldn't mind helping with some of them, a text says, "My partner has been told he urgently needs a new hip. The wait is 12 to 14 months. How does Dr. O'Byrne feel about going abroad for surgery? And he's only 50. I don't know who that text is from, but what do you think about people going to other jurisdictions, John? Because of waiting lists here.
Well, I think it's terrible that somebody has to wait for 12 to 15 months. And it is one of the stresses of our life, of our job, as Pat has said, to do an outpatient where you book somebody for something that you know you can do, but you're telling them 12 months. The concern I have, and I understand people going abroad, but the concern I have is some of the places that they may go to may not be necessarily giving them a good implant, may not necessarily be giving them the best treatment. There are some places abroad, and over the years, patients have gone to treatment purchase initiatives and that. And we've actually gone to look at them, and some of them are very good. So how could you be critical of somebody or a group of patients being sent to get treatment because it's so awful to leave them for 12 months? The concern, to answer the question, the concern I would have is where they are going and who is doing it and what implant they're doing, using, and how they're looking after them. And
Pat, you wanted to come in there.
The other point in this is that if we ship the problem abroad or elsewhere, we're never solving our problems ourselves. We're not taking responsibility in this country to really develop the structures and system. Like, one of the things, if you talk to David and you talk to John and we talk to anybody in this kind of game, throughout surgery in Ireland, there's been a tradition of going abroad, having expert training in the best centres in the world to come back here and give back to this country. Yeah. And you have people with a lot of talent. Yes, we need a lot more of them. But to actually have them effectively working with their hands tied half the time, unable to do what they can do, it's like having a fighter pilot who've invested millions in and they have him sitting in the tarmac.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy.
It seems just illogical, or just a crazy logic, that you all have to go abroad and you've all been abroad for experience.
Well, that's a strength too.
And of course it is, because you come back with, you know, the school of all sorts of things when you work abroad and you bring something back. But the fact then that we're training all these people so well, and then they're going and they're not coming back, so we're losing, I suppose, the skill, losing the craft of what it is you do to other jurisdictions.
Absolutely. And then you're not allowing the people who are here to maybe work at their maximum.
David, can I ask you about the hours? And again, we all work, we think, crazy hours. But again, do you guys, and I just looking from what I could gather, an 80-hour week would seem pretty standard for a surgeon in most hospitals.
I think the trouble with this game, I suppose, is that you're very much tied into emergencies. I cover what's called the National Primary PCI Programme in James's, and basically what that means is that if you have a heart attack in any part of the country, you'll be brought in immediately by ambulance to the centre where you can fix it, and there aren't that many centres in Dublin. It's basically the Mater and James's. So we cover the Eastern Seaboard and most of the Midlands. So at any time of the day, 24/7, if you have a heart attack, you'll be brought in, and the team then have about 20 minutes to get in. Now, again, this is the most challenging part of the job, but it's also the most enjoyable. But it does mean you have to put in fairly extensive hours.
Right. Mm. And does that go right through the sort of chain of command? Because, again, you know, it's common that we all work as hard as our bosses, or if our boss is doing 80 hours, you know, it tends to have a ripple effect.
Well, the irony now, I do some teaching in UCD, and they asked me to talk to some of the new interns a couple of weeks ago, the new junior doctors who are starting, and the irony now is that I work much harder than they're allowed to.
Right. Yeah.
So regulations have come in recent years that basically limit them to a 48-hour working week, whereas there's nothing stopping me.
Pat, I don't want to scare listeners here, but, you know, if I'm under the knife, I'd be kind of more relaxed, I think, if I'd known that you'd had a good night's sleep, or that you weren't working through the... In other words, you know, working 80, 90 hours a week, surely there's a risk around that, is there not?
There is a risk in working excessively. I guess we all thought when we got to be consultants that we would actually find we're working less than we were when we were registrars, but we actually find that we're as busy, if not more so. But there's two sides to it. You need a certain amount of experience and volume to, you know, to get to that level of expertise where you're competent and you're not even thinking about it, where you actually, your hands flow and you can do what you need to do without, you know, getting worried about the steps. So while you want certain safe working conditions, you don't necessarily want to rigidly restrict everyone that they can't get the experience. So there is a trade-off. But yeah, I mean, I suppose nowadays we're trying to limit ourselves and keep ourselves to kind of a 60-70 hour a week, so that you're reasonably fresh. And I'm lucky in that if I work in the children's hospital for my on call, that doesn't normally go late into the night, unlike the cardiac scene. So I'm reasonably fresh the following morning. I don't think I could be up all night and then doing a scoliosis operation, which is going to take 6 to 12 hours the following day. So you do try and look after yourself a bit in terms of not getting overstretched.
Tweet says, well said, Pat. We need our children to have access to services in Ireland, invest in services. Another texter asks, and we may as well get it out on the table, Bobby, can you please ask these guys about their considerable salaries? I wouldn't apologise for my salary. John, what's your thought on that? You work hard, you should be well paid.
Yeah, I think it's difficult because, you know, you've touched on how hard people are working, and the junior doctors work hard, and even now CAO points are coming out and parents see how hard their children have worked to get into medical school.
And the cost of it.
The cost, they work hard through medical school, and unfortunately, once you qualify, that's when all the work really starts, because they have so many exams to do, they do so much training, they go abroad at their own expense, so and often come back with huge debts. So it is always a kind of a touchy issue to talk about how much doctors should be paid. But they make huge sacrifices. Mm. They work really hard. And people, I'm 20 years a consultant, and I haven't spent that 20 years looking at people around me who are very wealthy and not working hard. I've seen people who work incredibly hard, just like Pat and David are talking about. That is the way people are. They work very hard. And the reimbursement varies, obviously, between different specialties, and it varies on how hard you work.
Can I also ask about the cost of operations, David? Mm. Again, is there a sort of a disconnect? I remember being horrified when my daughter had an operation in Crumlin many years ago and seeing that it cost 20 grand. And I, you know, because you never actually see the money, or no one asked me to pay 20,000, I'm removed from it. Is that a problem, that we don't appreciate how much each operation actually costs?
It's a tricky question, I suppose. There certainly are discrepancies across specialties in terms of what things cost. I suppose, you know, to break it down, a stent costs €400. A lot of the kit we would use, I suppose, to do a procedure for us probably costs in the region of €2,000 or €3,000.
Right.
And then I suppose you have to factor in all the other costs, the overheads, the nursing staff, the technicians, the everything else. So I suppose the cost ratchets up fairly quickly when you consider it. And then I suppose it's how do you put a price on these things. So you have to come in at some level.
But would I be right in saying, Pat, when you're in the operating theatre doing your work, the last thing on your mind is the cost of anything? Would that be right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you're just completely focused on what you need to get the best result for that individual, no matter how long it takes, and everything else goes out the window. One of my colleagues says it's just, you know, operating is like being in a bubble. You're in a bubble, and actually the outside world doesn't involve. You kind of get into a flow like in a sports scene or whatever, and really you're just focused on that. The cost does not come into it. Currently anyway, but that may change depending on
it's our model,
who's in control.
It
is our model to a degree,
but
if we're spending so much in health, as you pointed out, I mean, 5 grand a head per everyone in this population is a lot of money. You wonder, could we deploy the resources more effectively to get a more efficiency and a better value for money, for sure.
It's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you all for letting us into your world and speaking so frankly. I want to end on one text that says, "Hey Bobby, I love the show. Very important question. Are any of these surgeons single?" That's from Fiona. Thank you, Fiona, for that. Okay.